Welcome to Two Bees in a Podcast, brought to you by the Honeybee Research and Extension Laboratory at the University of Florida's Institute of Food and Agricultural Sciences. It is our goal to advance the understanding of honeybees and beekeeping, grow the beekeeping community, and improve the health of honeybees everywhere. In this podcast, you'll hear research updates, beekeeping management practices discussed, and advice on beekeeping from our resident experts, beekeepers, scientists, and other program guests. Join us for today's program, and thank you for listening to Two Bees in a Podcast. Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of Two Bees in a Podcast. Amy and I are very privileged today to be joined by Dr. Mohammed Albaraki, who is a research entomologist at the USDA ARSB Research Laboratory in Beltsville, Maryland in the USA. And he and his colleagues did a really interesting study that they've published that I think, even though it's a lot of U.S. data, that it has really international implications. And that study is entitled, Honeybee Populations of the USA Display Restrictions in Their Mitochondrial DNA Haplotype Diversity. Beekeepers, I know that study title was a mouthful, but Mohammed is going to break it down in so much detail so that you guys can appreciate what he and his colleagues did. Mohammed, thank you so much for joining us on this episode of Two Bees in a Podcast.
Thank you very much, Jimmy, for having me. And it's really a great pleasure to be here with you and your audience.
You know, the topic that you and your colleagues publish is very interesting to me. It's something that's kind of growing in me over the last 10 years of an interest in my own lab. So I really want to jump straight into the science, but I'm afraid before we get there, I have to kind of ask the first question that we always ask our first-time guests, which is, could you tell us a little bit about yourself and how you got into bee research in the first place?
Yeah, sure. I'm Mohammed Albaraki, and I am a second generation beekeeper in my family. So my dad used to keep bees and in the Middle East. And I grew up with bees basically from a very young age. And my dad also is a scientist. So he did research in France and honeybee behavior too. So this is where I started growing up with bees and beekeeping with my family and as a professional beekeeper. So a little bit about my education. So my background, I hold a bachelor degree in agriculture, and I studied in the Department of Entomology from the University of Damascus. And I grew up in France. I was born in Syria. I grew up in France. I did my PhD in France at the University of Pierre et Marie Curie. And I worked in the CNRS lab in Paris. So my PhD research was really on the genetic diversity of honeybees. And then I moved to Canada, where I worked at Laval University in Quebec. I did my first postdoc, and I studied there a little bit different concept, but it was to study how agriculture pesticides are affecting bee health. And then I moved to the US in 2014, and I did my first postdoc in the US at the University of Tennessee. And I continued at that time working on the effect of pesticides on bees. That was a very productive postdoc there for 3 years. And then I did a short postdoc at University of USM, Southern Miss, in the state of Mississippi. And I worked more on the same principle, but it was more how the stressors, the abiotic and biotic stressors, are affecting the gene regulation of bees. And so recently, or not really recently, in 2019, I moved to Maryland, and I'm currently, I got a position here. I'm currently a research entomologist at the USDA Bee Research Lab in Beltsville.
Mohammed, you know, I think I'm amazed, first of all, by your experience. It seems like you've had just a lot of experience in many different locations. And I think, you know, we've had other beekeepers that are second generation beekeepers. Jamie, you can correct me if I'm wrong. I don't think we've had a single guest that's second generation honeybee researcher.
Yeah, I know. That is interesting. That's one of the things that I was listening to when you were talking about that. You had mentioned your father had worked with honeybees, both professionally as a beekeeper and as a scientist. And that's pretty cool. That's new.
Yeah, that is, in fact, that is amazing because I still, up till today, I debate scientific ideas becoming practice with my dad. He was here visiting from Canada and he was telling me, no, this doesn't work like this. You have to change your idea about that. And this and this. So it's a great opportunity, in fact, you're right. And then the other thing is being scientist also, and being a beekeeper first and then a scientist will mm-hmm. give you the opportunity to start implementing in your research, what would benefit the beekeepers and solve their problems?
Absolutely. I think you and your dad should do a podcast together. Just every time you guys are debating something, just record it.
Oh, yeah, that's a good idea.
All right. So now we are getting to the publication. And in the publication, you were looking at honeybee populations in the USA and their mitochondrial DNA. Okay, I'm going to say mitochondrial DNA haplotype diversity. I really need to go back and take biology, but can you go ahead and tell our audience what is mitochondrial DNA and why do we even look at it?
Okay, great question. In fact, to simplify things, you can replace in that hard to understand title somehow, maternal diversity. Instead of haplotype and mitochondrial DNA, is that we are looking at the diversity received from the mother side, which is the queen in that aspect. Now the title has changed because I had some debate with some of the reviewers, and they wanted to be more precise, and I knew that this would be more difficult for general public to read and understand, but now I can tell you that it's just the maternal diversity. And the mitochondrial DNA itself is a circular chromosome that is located in the cellular organelles, which we call the mitochondria. And the specificity, and all those are located in the cytoplasm, but the specificity of the mitochondrial DNA is that it has a uniparental inheritance. So basically we get it as it is, to make it simple, from our mothers, with little to no recombination, and its structure is conserved. So basically it's like a marker, a tool that you pass on through many generations. Now, using that tool, you can track down like way, way back your ancestors and from where you come. And the closest example that we understand in a simple manner is that recently I've seen some advertisement on the TV of the 21andMe and the Ancestry DNA kit. In fact, I took that test. It's like $100. You do it. And those companies, in fact, they use the mitochondrial DNA to tell you, you know what, you came from Italy, you came from East Europe, South Europe, from Africa, you've got ancestors from here and there in the old world. And it's pretty, people are very keen to use it in the US to know from where we came, in fact, as a nation of immigrants here. So that is the concept of the mitochondrial DNA. Now, to simplify, we have mainly two major markers on honeybees. We can start study the paternal heredity, what we are getting in terms of genetics from the fathers, which are the drones in our case, or we study the mtDNA and we know our lineages from where those queens came originally. Now every marker is different from the other, but what we usually do is we first type using the mitochondrial DNA, and then we understand 50% of our genetics from where it's coming. And then we see what we have inherited from our parents, fathers. And this is what we call the parental heredity, the paternal heredity, sorry. So this paper, Amy, is basically tackling a portion of the diversity in the population of the US. Let's say 50% of the diversity is tracked by this marker that we've used in this study.
And this marker is very common with honeybee looking at the lineages, right?
Now, that's a very interesting question too. The thing is that, yeah, this is a universal marker, not only for honeybees, it is used for human beings, it's used for any type of phylogeographic analysis and study. And why? Because the reason is that it's so conserved, and when it is passed through, there is very little modification. And basically, it will give you an idea way back to where you belong and from where you came by this marker, as the mother will pass it through their progeny intact, not intact completely, but in a very similar manner. I'm trying to really simplify here. So there is no recombination, very low rate of recombination in this marker. And it's very common, in fact. Now, the other thing that I would like to add here is that you know, when our beekeepers, they say, oh, I've got a Italian queen, I've got a Carniolan queen, those are maybe they are mixed, maybe they are African of origin and stuff like that. They look at the color, you know, that's good because they've got experience and they, but in fact, the color is just a phenotype and it's one attribute that will represent the genetic background of a living organism, or bees in our case. Here, the marker will, the mtDNA will not lie. It will tell you, based on the analysis that we did in this study and that other people did, it will tell you that this is 100% Italian mother, Italian queen, or this is 100% black bee, Mellifera mellifera, and so on and so forth. So this marker, particular marker that we use, the CO1, CO2 region of this marker, has been used to basically determine what subspecies we are dealing with. And this is very important to know.
So Mohammed, there's really so much to unpack here, because when you're talking about maternal lineages, when you're talking about paternal lineages, and you're looking at specifically mitochondrial DNA, which of course is maternally inherited, like you said, it comes down from the mothers. There's very little change over time. It's relatively stable. And you keep using these words, lineages, honeybee lineages. You're using it to look at honeybee diversity and honeybee lineages. So could you tell us a little bit about what a honeybee lineage is, what the major honeybee lineages are? Because that's going to segue into my next question is, well, how specifically did you use this marker to look at these things?
Okay, awesome. So basically, we know currently that we have different subspecies of bees. Those subspecies, within each subspecies, we have different haplotypes, okay? Now, the upper level of classification of subspecies is evolutionary lineages. So bees, they've been classified to evolutionary lineages based on their evolution throughout millions of years after the last glaciation. Bees came back to some geographical area and then they've started to adapt, and then they've recolonized. This is in the old world, not in the US, in the US and the new land. So based on this, based on that movement, they have recolonized different geographical area. And then the resemblance in their genetic material, and in this case is the mtDNA, allowed to classify them into a group. You can imagine like lineages are group. We have a group of West Europe. We have a group of the African continent. We have a group of the Middle East. We have a group of Southeast Europe. This is the definition of lineages. And every lineage will comprise basically different subspecies. And every subspecies has different haplotypes. Now, how many? We're looking at that. A lot of people did a lot of studies, but the main thing to understand is that more haplotypes you have within a subspecies, it means that you have more diversity eventually. I mean, why they are differing then? Now, your other question is how we detect that. Well, that is the beauty of the marker, the mtDNA CO1, CO2 region, which is a non-coding region located between the cytochrome oxidase 1 and 2. And this was discovered by my former PhD supervisor, Dr. Lionel Garnery and others, as well as Dr. Soliniak, his supervisor. They discovered that this region is, this is a non-coding region, or if you want, some people, they like to call it the junk region. It doesn't code for anything, in fact. But when they've started studying this region, they've discovered that sometimes this region is longer. It's like exceeding 100 base pairs. Sometimes shorter. And this length and difference in that region, those people, in fact, and scientists, they've linked it to the diversity of the bees. So they've seen that in some location, it's longer, shorter. There is difference in the structure of this region. And they link that to the geographical locations of the samples. And then they were able to map that molecular marker with the previously great research done by Rittner et al. And Rittner is a famous bee scientist from Germany. They were able to map this molecular marker and compare it with what he has already described as lineage, but as lineages on bees throughout his life, but based on morphometrical characteristic, because he was working on, you know, the 45 different morphometrical characteristics on bees. And then he was able to determine throughout his travels that, okay, those bees are African, those bees are from West Europe, those bees are this subspecies, those are Mellifera mellifera, those are Ligustica. And he differentiated that based on their phenotypes. And now, because this group of people were able to link this molecular marker with the previous work done on morphometrical characteristics, we can now use this marker to type, and it's much faster and more reliable because the DNA will not lie. Basically, it's not like a phenotype that is usually affected by the environmental condition or the adaptation or other environmental stressors.
So I'm interested in how you collect the honeybees, your samples, and you know what that whole process kind of looks like.
Okay, that's a great question, Amy. In fact, for the mtDNA is much simpler than the paternal marker for a simple reason, because a bee colony, a honeybee colony with one single queen will have the same type, the same mtDNA type. They will all have the same haplotype signature, if you want. And because they all belong to the same mother, and the mm-hmm. mother, the queen, has passed through this mtDNA as it is. And then when we study this region, we see that they are all the same haplotype. They should be. If we find a bee with a different haplotype from the same colony, it means that this bee has most probably drafted or came from mm-hmm. elsewhere, or is just stealing from the hive, or it's not. But that's very, very rare. So basically every colony will have the same, will exhibit the same haplotype, whether it's a C1 or C2J or African haplotype or West Mediterranean haplotype M2, M1. So for us, we've sampled, and I should acknowledge on the collaboration of the University of Maryland, and particularly Dr. Dennis Van Angeltorp, for really supplying us with the majority of the sample from the National Honeybee Survey. This helped a lot. So we've sampled basically what we need for this type of analysis is a single bee from a colony, because we are in fact not typing the colony, we are typing the queens.
Right.
Because any bee that you analyze, basically you are analyzing the mother, the queen, but you don't want to kill the queen. So you just take her daughter. And that is the beauty of this marker. Now, the paternal heredity is completely different, but we may talk about it later on if you want, guys, but not in this context.
Yeah, absolutely. So you took the samples, you were looking at their lineages, and so I'm wondering, you know, what lineages did you find in the United States, and do they differ between states or even maybe within states?
Okay, so what we do is we take those bees, we do an DNA extraction, we extract their total DNA, and then we do some cooking and we get this marker, we amplify this region of interest, and then we cleave this region with some enzymes, and then we look at the profile. And then here you need experience to know what is this profile. I mean, otherwise you will be looking at a gel or a fragment analysis that's difficult to comprehend. But then basically you will characterize those haplotypes based on their pattern of restriction. And then you see, okay, I got 20, 30 sample from the state of Florida, okay, you guys, I'm going to talk about Florida since you are hosting the podcast from there. So I've got 20 samples from Florida. Those are from 20 beekeepers mainly. Every beekeeper has different operation from the other. So basically, it will give us an idea. Now, our sampling, the United States is a huge country. Our sampling is well scattered, but it is not of high, like we don't have a high number of samples per state. For example, what we were able to do from the same year is to really collect 22 to 23, 24 sample per state. But the beauty of it is that we can later on, eventually, every state can amplify this number and do more targeted research within their state. But for now, for us, we wanted to do a nationwide survey to really just explore what we have currently. And since our sample are very well scattered, so they give a very good representation on the diversity we have. Now, in the state of Florida, let's say we have 24 sample, we analyze them, and then they all came from the same lineage. How we detected that? By using this marker. So we analyze the sample with this marker, and then we see that they are all the haplotypes. The haplogroup belongs to the same maternal lineage. And then we will say, okay, guys, Florida has 100% of its sample from the C lineage, or the M lineage, or the African lineage, and so on and so forth. And then we can go in depth a little bit more. We can precise what type of haplotypes they have in Florida. We're using the same test. This is why this test is extremely powerful, in fact. And then we can give an estimation of what we call the haplotype diversity. Now, haplotype, you can imagine the haplotype is like a sub-subspecies, if you want. So we already have subspecies, but as a single subspecies, like let's say Ligustica, it can have, not Ligustica, Carnica has different haplotypes, and we can consider them for now subspecies, if you want, to really facilitate the word of haplotypes. But this haplotype diversity basically will reflect the genetic diversity we have within each subspecies, as well as within each evolutionary lineage.
So you guys have done a lot of work with all these bees that were from the National Survey that represents a good survey of bees from around the country. It's really fascinating you're able to do this by state. So I'm kind of dying to know, what are some of the primary findings that came out of your research?
Yes, thank you, Jimmy. So so I'll go over the main findings and really simplify them in couple sentences. So the major thing that we need to understand, and that as a beekeeper myself, I would love to know, is what is the percentage represented of each lineage within our population in the US nationwide. Now, nationwide first, and then in my particular state. And that's a question that I think every beekeeper would love to hear an answer. So basically nationwide, what we found is that 94, and I'm rounding the numbers for more details, you guys can go to the paper. 94% of the whole sample, and our sample were 1,062 sample, belong in fact to the C lineage, the North Mediterranean lineage. I will give some more detail about what is the North Mediterranean lineage. For some people, it's just an alphabetic letter, see. And then 3% are from the West Mediterranean lineage, and 3% were from the African lineage. Now, the C lineage is mainly represented by many subspecies that we know of. I'll cite some, like Ligustica, the Italian bees, Craniolan bees, Carnica, Macedonica, Cecropia, Cypria, Cecropia too. And the origin of this lineage is Central and Southeastern Europe. Now, the second lineage is the M lineage, which is the West Mediterranean lineage. This lineage is nice lineage because it's represented by only two subspecies, which makes our job much easier, in fact. And those two subspecies are Mellifera mellifera, the black honeybee, located now mainly in France, but in West Europe, as well as Iberiensis, a little bit south, like North Spain, Portugal, those areas. And then you have the African lineage. This lineage is a beautiful lineage with the highest diversity that we know of. Now, it has some bad reputation because of the Africanized bees, but we really try to clarify that concept in this paper we did. The Africanized context, the Africanized term is completely different from African haplotype or African lineage. They are completely separate notions. Now, the African lineage has 13 different subspecies, you know, including Entermisa, Syriaca, Lamarckii, Sahariensis, and Yemenitica, and so forth, and Scutellata. So we have 13 subspecies, well-defined subspecies on the African lineage, and its location is the whole African continent.
It's really great that you guys were able to look at this across the U.S. Actually, I'm really quite fascinated because you still have 3% from that Western Mediterranean lineage and 3% from the African lineage, which it could include, you know, snippets from any number of subspecies there. So you did this at the U.S. level. You mentioned also doing it at the state level. So can readers of this manuscript see at the state level what you found?
Yes. In fact, I took into consideration this specific aspect because I know that every beekeeper from different state would love to see what's going on in their own state. What I did is I put a very simple table, although it's a long table, but I emphasize that we need to keep it in the manuscript. And I detailed per state the lineage found, and per state also the number of haplotype found and the haplotype diversity, as well as the name of each haplotype found per state. And I added also the novel haplotypes, because we identified 14 novel haplotypes and where they are in each state, if they have novel haplotypes or not. So all these information, in fact, they are detailed in a very simple manner, I hope. I mean, they seem very, very simple and clear. Like this, every beekeeper can go back, okay, I'm from North Dakota, I'll see where is North Dakota, I see what do we have, what those people are saying we have. Of course, within the scope of our sampling size, we need to know that because this is already a lot of sample analyzed, but we can't analyze like thousands and thousands of samples from the same state. Now, this is the job of the local authorities and local labs to emphasize more on their state and identify maybe more diversity or not, or this is up to the state level to determine.
You know, I want to go back to my comment earlier about you being a honeybee, a beekeeper growing up as a second generation beekeeper and a researcher, because I think it really shows, you know, when we're talking to you that you're doing great research, you're considering, you know, everything from the research perspective, but also you want to be practical. And so you want it to help the beekeepers as well. So I applaud you on that, because I think it's very apparent when we're talking to you on this podcast.
Well, awesome. That means a lot to me, Annie. Thank you.
Yeah. So, you know, I get to ask you the million-dollar question, and that is, what does this all mean for beekeepers?
Okay. So this is the most important question, in my opinion. And we did all the studies just because we want to better the life of beekeepers, basically. And also at the national level, we want to take care of our honeybee populations to make sure that they are healthy and that they can sustain ourselves and our next generations to come. And this question is very interesting because we need to be sensitive to a very critical point here, is that the US doesn't have its own native honeybee subspecies. We basically imported everything from the old world. So we don't have a native honeybee here, and then we've imported everything. But you know, maybe we have not imported enough, let's say, or maybe we have just imported a small chunk of the diversity found in the old world. You need to keep in mind that those bees, they've evolved in the old world for millions of years. We're not talking about like 100 years or 10 years or decades. So they've developed very sophisticated adaptation to their local environment, to their local predator, disease, and so on, as it is expected for any living organism. Now we've brought them here, but now we need to understand that, are they healthy here? Do we have a healthy diversity? Now the general consensus is that the more diversity you have, the better for the health of any given population, including human being, by the way. But let's stick to bees here. More diverse honeybee population will mean that you have more genetic traits that will be able to face the challenges, environmental stressors, abiotic, biotic stressor, disease, health, productivity. Now, a declined diversity within a population is very bad, because it will create a bottleneck, a genetic bottleneck that we call, or an inbreeding process that will limit the traits of resistance to disease and adaptation to climate and et cetera, et cetera. So what we did, in fact, the whole study here is that to check with beekeepers at the national level and state level, do we have like a healthy diversity in our honeybee population? Or do we need to work harder and find and improve this diversity? Because everything that we face in the nature, in the environment, in the flora or forage that you have in the field, is basically reflected. You can take advantage of it based on your genetic capacity. So the adaptation is based on your genetic background. If you have a diverse genetic background, you can deal with much more challenges than if you are in an inbreeding process and you have a very limited attributes, genetic attributes. If you face a new predator, then you can't defend yourself. If you face a new disease, you don't have what it takes genetically to be able to overcome this challenge. And that's a very critical point to understand.
So you and your colleagues have done a lot of work, and this is really fascinating. It's very exciting. I'm just curious, what are some of your follow-up plans? You mentioned a lot about this paternal versus maternal. Are you guys going to follow up looking at paternal lineages? What do you guys have planned next?
Yes, in fact, that is what we are working on currently. Now, we did the phase number one, and fortunately, we have those samples. We've already extracted the DNA. They are saved at minus 20. Now, the next phase that I would like to do is to, since now we've evaluated the maternal diversity and we know every single sample from where it has been sampled, when, from which state, and we know its haplotype and its lineage, now we are going to check using a different marker, which is this time a genomic marker, mainly using the microsatellite loci marker, to define the paternal heredity, how much diversity we are having from the father's side, in our case, is the drones. Now, we will use a different marker, and this time it's not going to be on the mitochondrial DNA, as I said earlier, it's going to be on the genomic DNA, the huge DNA, because the mitochondrial DNA basically is like just 16 KB. It's a small circular DNA. Now, here we are dealing with a different technique that we'll be using, and this technique is also, I think we are familiar with it, because it's used even in hospital or even in investigation here and there to prove the paternal, the fathers in crime scene and so on and so forth. So this is the marker that we are going to use. And then we're going to say, okay, we're going to link what we have diversity from the maternal side. And then after our phase two, we will see what the same sample have from their paternal side, and then we will make a comparison. But make no mistake now, this is a very simple idea here that I would like to clarify. The queens are the origin of the drones. I mean, the drones are not gonna pop up from the sky or drop from the sky on us, you know. Originally, they carry the the genetics of their mother, except if you are bringing drones from outside the studied population. So basically, they might vary a little bit, but my own expectation, and I may be wrong, but I would estimate that what we will found in the paternal side won't differ too much from what we have on the maternal lineages. It will bring a little bit maybe more diversity, but this is to be seen because a simple reason in a closed population, the drones are originated from the queens. And what we will find from the drones is it will be approximately, it will differ definitively, but it will not differ too much. So, but we'll see, maybe we'll get surprised. And this is really the phase number two that we are going to do using those same sample. And hopefully we can bring the results to the scientific community and the beekeepers to really have a full picture of the overall diversity of the US honeybee population.
So Mohammed, you've really done a great job explaining something that's very technical throughout. I know all of our listeners everywhere around the world are going to really appreciate this, and they're going to wonder the second thing, which is, well, gosh, what is the genetic diversity in the country or the region where I live? So you might be inspiring research projects to pop up all over the place on this topic. So Amy and I wish you the best of luck moving forward into phase two, and thank you so much for joining us on Two Bees in a Podcast.
Thank you very much for having me.
You know what, Jamie, talked to me 10, 15 years ago, I don't think I would have ever imagined I was sitting here talking about mitochondrial DNA, haplotype diversity, and honeybee populations.
Well, you're lucky to be here then.
I'm so fortunate to be here.
It's a fascinating topic to me. And it, obviously in our own lab, it's something that I'm got a growing interest in. And so I find it fascinating, quite frankly.
Well, you know, just looking at the abstract, when I was reading the publication, I was just like, oh my gosh, there's so much on here that I just don't understand. I don't understand the background. You know, what is going on? And then after talking to him, I was like, wow, this is really cool. And I can see how, I know that you're very passionate about it. And so I can definitely see how it's very just intriguing to understand the different lineages and the different species and subspecies of honeybees.
Yeah, so he did a really good job explaining it. And we knew coming in, right, that this was going to be a little bit of a difficult topic. But the shortest potential explanation is that animals carry DNA in their nucleus, and they carry DNA in their mitochondria. And the mitochondrial DNA, which is what we've been talking about, exclusively comes from the mom. The nuclear DNA is, in the case of humans at least, half mom and half dad, and the same is true for worker honeybees. It's a little bit different when we talk about drones, but that's another story for another day. And so you can use this mitochondrial DNA to understand the genetic diversity. And you mentioned species and subspecies of honeybees. You know, just a few years ago, I was telling people there were 9 honeybee species. Well, now I'm telling people there's 10. And now I'm looking at more data, thinking that there may be more. Right. And just within Mellifera, the species that we keep and study ourselves, there's 30, maybe 35 subspecies. And he's arguing that within a subspecies, you get a lot of diversity. And that diversity is represented among things called haplotypes. And so we've done some work on honeybees in South Africa, where we were looking at diversity within Apis mellifera capensis, the Cape honeybee, and we found it was remarkably diverse. Same thing for Scutellata, Apis mellifera scutellata. And that's what he's doing. He's looking across the diversity here in the U.S. And to make it a little bit more digestible, most beekeepers are very aware of the fact that there are these different lineages. He mentioned the ACMO lineages, the A, B, and the African, the M, the most notable subspecies in the M lineage is Apis mellifera mellifera, the German black bee, or the black bee, or the dark honeybee. And then the C lineage that has things like Ligustica, the Italian honeybee. And there's also some other cryptic lineages that may exist, and we might see those in the U.S. in some of these analyses. So it's a really interesting first step looking at the genetic diversity. And I love the fact that he mentioned that he's going to follow up looking at the paternal lineages, which you can only do in honeybees, and for that matter, animals in general, by looking at the nuclear DNA.
Yeah, I mean, just looking at the lineages, you know, being able to separate them out by that North Mediterranean, the West Mediterranean, the African lineages, it sometimes I'm just like, it's just all a melting pot, right? But it's not. I mean, it is, but at the same time, there are just very specific lines going way back.
So Amy, you make a really important point. Because the mitochondrial DNA is so conserved, but from one generation to the next, I would suspect, and I could be wrong here, but I would suspect you would see more, for lack of a better term, true lineage representation. Mm-hmm. Whereas when you look at the nuclear DNA that's contributed from the mom and the drone, and there's crossover, and within a colony, there's multiple drones represented in a single hive, right? You mm-hmm. can get what I think will be more of a melting pot of lineages. So whereas your mitochondrial lineage might be, let's just say for the sake of argument, the C lineage, and the nuclear lineage could be something entirely different based on the drone contributions. It gets complicated fast. But why is all this important in the first place? Well, that's what Muhammad kept mentioning, this idea of diversity. And knowing diversity precedes knowing whether or not conservation is important. And he mentioned that it's possible that we have somewhat reduced diversity here in the United States since there's no native honeybees. But he also talked about the ridiculous diversity that you see in Africa, for example, mm-hmm. from the African lineages. So thinking about conservation, thinking about improving the stocks that we have in the U.S., and for that matter, folks around the world are taking up this cause as well. All of that kind of starts with, what do we have? How right. diverse is what we have? And that's an important first step.
All right. I have to finish this episode just by saying that, you know, Muhammad is doing the 23andMe.
I was thinking the same thing. I thought about weren't. That. No, I have said that actually before to other people. When people, there's actually places you can send your bees to get them genotyped. And I've always thought that they should call it 23andMe, but maybe yeah. they will. Maybe
I said it first.
You at least said it first on the podcast. I'll give you credit for that.
That's fair.
It's everybody's favorite game show, Stump the Chump.
All right, welcome back, beekeepers, to the Q&A segment. Jamie, the first question we have today. So the question is, should beekeepers be treating proactively? And with this question, I am going to assume that they're talking about Varroa. So do you think that beekeepers should be treating for Varroa proactively?
So I do not think that they should, Amy. I mean, and I think the data bear this out, and it's going to come with a couple of caveats, but I'll state from the front end, you should only control problems you have, not problems you don't have. And so the theory of integrated pest management rests on the assumption that you are going to do as many non-chemical things as possible to keep Varroa numbers below an economic threshold. And then, and if they reach the threshold, you can use chemical treatment intervention. So what does that look like practically? Well, maybe you use screen bottom boards and resistant stock or drone brood removal or whatever. You're doing non-chemical things to reduce the Varroa populations. Simultaneously, you are sampling for Varroa throughout the production season. And as long as your Varroa numbers are below the economic threshold, you don't need to treat with a chemical. So that economic threshold is roughly 2 to 3 mites per 100 bees. We usually say 3 mites per 100 adult bees, as discovered through a alcohol wash, but you know, it all depends on time of year, and the Honeybee Health Coalition table of Varroa treatment shows that. It shows you what the economic threshold is based on the condition of the colony, but it's usually around 3 mites per 100 bees. So as long as your chemical-free treatments, your bottom screens, your resistant queens, your drone brood removal, whatever it is you're using, as long as your non-chemical treatments keep the Varroa loads below 3 mites per 100 bees, you don't need to treat with a chemical. So you'd be wasting money applying a chemical. Mm-hmm. And furthermore, the more you treat with chemicals, the more likely Varroa are going to become resistant to those chemicals. So integrated pest management is structured in such a way that you do as many non-chemical treatment options as possible and only treat when you hit the threshold. Now, that sounds good for me to say. It sounds good for everybody out there listening to hear, but it can be tricky in practice, especially for commercial beekeepers. Right? Think about it this way. Let's say you've got 10,000 colonies and an apiary has 40 colonies. you go in and find one colony. So now you've got a simple sample 10,000 colonies, and you need to do it maybe once a month. There are strategies out there where you can sample fewer colonies per apiary, but let's just say for the sake of argument that you still have to sample one third of your colonies once a month. Well, that's 3,333 colonies once a month you've got to do varroa washes on. Well, then on top of that, what happens if only one colony in your apiary is over 3 mites per 100 bee? Do you treat it? Do you treat the apiary? What if 2 of the 40 or 20 of the 40? So commercial beekeepers, a lot of commercial beekeepers, I don't want to make a blanket statement, will just simply say, you know, regular sampling is just not worth it. It's too time consuming. There's too many colonies. There's too many what ifs. And on top of that, let's say I hit 3 mites per 100 bee and I'm in the middle of a honey flow. Am I going to treat and not be able to use that honey? Or am I going to get the bees through the honey flow and then treat? So they say, considering how complex the commercial beekeeping landscape may be, maybe it's not beneficial for us to sample and treat only when we exceed the economic threshold. Maybe we should treat when we have known designated treatment windows that are outside production and that we know are necessary for keeping varroa from hitting the threshold a month or 2 months from now. So I argue that it's never best to treat proactively. You should always treat in response to varroa crossing that threshold, 3 mites per 100 bees. But a lot of people who are big scale beekeepers find that difficult to implement because of the cumbersome sampling, because of the timing of the year, the production season, the treatments that are available. And so a lot of those guys and girls will just treat on schedule. And they're like, it's okay if we have to treat an extra time or two on schedule, because that beats the cost of sampling or the cost of this or the other. And until there are economic models showing overwhelmingly that the IPM approach is best, I think you're going to continue seeing that strategy in the commercial industry where we treat in our known treatment windows rather than kind of build on top of this IPM. We're going to sample, we're going to treat when we exceed it. So the simple question was, is should we beekeepers be treating proactively for, and you said for varroa? I would say they shouldn't be, but I understand it's the real world and the real answer is very complicated depending on management setting.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you brought up the commercial industry for sure, but I think even as a hobbyist, you know, before I started working at the lab, I was pretty intimidated by the whole process of monitoring, you know, using the alcohol wash. I wasn't sure if I was doing it right. And so I think sometimes even for hobbyist backyard beekeepers, it can be kind of intimidating. And so it's just easier to, you know, purchase something, slap it on the hive and be done with it. Right. And so, so I think that's the reality versus theory with both. I think, yeah, we can agree. Should they be? Probably not. But do they? Probably.
Yeah. I mean, it's tough, Amy. You've hit the nail on the head. The best recommendations are to use non-chemical treatment options until you hit the threshold, and then you can treat with the chemical. And we even have preliminary data from my postdoc days at the University of Georgia that shows that that economically is more beneficial than just treating on schedule. But it's just hard. It's just hard. The world is complex. And if you're living in Florida versus living in England versus living in South Africa versus living in Australia versus living in Germany versus living in Florida, you know, California, you can understand that it's just complicated. It's difficult. And I'm a stuck record, but the Honeybee Health Coalition's Varroa Treatment Guide really talks about this, and they walk you through how IPM is best done. And of course, you'll remember Dr. Cameron Jack and I published a research manuscript on varroa integrated pest management that we can link in the show notes today to kind of give it more of an academic spin as well. And we've got series of recommendations in there too. So there's a lot of thought going into this, but it's not as clear cut as we'd all like it to be.
All right. Well, speaking about complicated matters, that leads me into my next question. How is climate change impacting honeybees? So if you could just answer that question, you know, in a sentence, tell me how you'll save the world. That would be great.
Okay. Well, listen, this is a very politically charged question, right? You know, surveys show that in the United States, at least, maybe only half of the people believe in it and the other half don't. I think maybe around the world, you get a greater percentage of individuals believing in climate change. But in the U.S., it seems to be split down the middle, you know, half and half. And you know, I'm not going to even dip my pinky toe into the political aspect of this, because I know we've got a lot of listeners from all around the world listening to this. So there's a lot of varied perspectives here. But I would say the research data suggests that storms are frequent, that the world is warming. And the question is how are bees going to handle this? Well, a couple things come to mind. Number one, there's not a huge, robust literature associated with climate change and honeybees. So it's an emerging research topic. And I feel like in the next 10 years, it's going to absolutely explode onto the scene with scientists all around the world studying this, at least bee scientists. It's just understudied at the moment. All right. But one can imagine that a warming Earth with all of these other things that happen as a result of that, more rain or less rain or increased temperatures, et cetera, all of those things can affect plant phenology, plant success, plant distribution, plant bloom, plant availability of nectar or pollen, because their pests and diseases, plant pests and diseases, are affected by these warming temperatures. Their distributions are affected by these warming temperatures. You know, I'm in South Africa right now as I answer this question, and there's been an 8-year drought where I am. And locals here, everybody we've spoken to, have talked about the reduction in the number of wild honeybee colonies they've seen, just because the plant life responded to this significant drought. It died or it decreased. And so as a result, there's less forage for bees. I can give another example of a potential impact with honeybees. You know, in Florida, we have Africanized honeybees in the southern half of our state. In the U.S., they're in the southwestern U.S. as well, Southern California, Texas, you know, Oklahoma, New Mexico, Arizona, places like that. Well, if we're getting incremental increases in temperature and significant climate change, you can imagine a scenario where their distribution starts to expand. The reason they're not in the rest of the United States is because they don't overwinter well. You know, they don't cluster well. Well, if it warms, and maybe they can move up. Maybe they're in Georgia in 30 years or in wherever, you know, established populations up north even after that. Maybe their spread to places in Europe will be facilitated. Europe has going for it that it's got, in a lot of places, cold winters, and that's not something that African honeybees can survive. Or maybe the spread of bee pests. Small hive beetles may be all over the U.S., but their damage, their significant damage, is really in the southern states. Well, maybe if it starts to warm, you'll see significant apiary-wide damages in the northern states. We know the small hive beetles now in Europe. It's in Italy. Well, if it warms in Europe, you might see them in Germany and Finland or Sweden. You know, who knows how the honeybee diseases and pests will be affected by these expanding range distributions made possible through a warming Earth. And I will throw on top of that, you know, the honeybee that we keep, Apis mellifera, has a natural distribution from northern Europe to the southern tip of Africa. So that means it lives in cold environment, wet environments, dry environment, hot environment, windy environment, and you name it. So the species itself probably will not struggle that much. But specific subspecies that are acclimated to very specific environmental parameters or conditions in certain areas, they could suffer. For example, Apis mellifera mellifera is a very cold, hardy honeybee. It's the northern European honeybee. Maybe it can't do as well in warming climates. Maybe Scutellata or capensis or some of these other warm adjusted or adapted bees are going to do well in these warming climates. So it's difficult to predict because there's not been a ton of research on it, but it's not very big stretch to suggest their diseases and pests will be impacted. They will be impacted. The plants on which they rely will be impacted. So you could really envision a scenario where it significantly impacts honeybees. And I think this will be an increasing story in the news, kind of in the research and beekeeping world as well, moving forward in the next decade or two.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, good job. That was a good response to how to change how the world is changing the world of honeybees.
Well, yeah.
All right. So the third question. So this question has been a topic of discussion at many of the associations, and just I've seen it online and people have just been bringing it up to me left and right. And so let's answer it. So the question is, people have been using soapy water, like Dawn dish soap or, you know, just a general dish soap, to monitor for varroa instead of alcohol. So the question is, one, is it okay to use soapy water to monitor for varroa, or, you know, is it as good as alcohol at all?
So, I mean, I would say it's okay to use soapy water. And I would say we don't know how good it is relative to alcohol. So you and I were talking about this a little bit before we got on the air. I know Jennifer mm-hmm. Serena from the University of Tennessee and Jeff Williams from Auburn University have been looking at the efficacy of using powdered sugar versus alcohol when you're doing these Varroa washes. But I'm not aware of any studies with soapy water versus alcohol when doing these Varroa washes. And if any of you listeners out there are aware of some of those studies, you can just let me know. And then Amy and I in the future can re-answer that question or this question. But I will say even with the lack of that information, it's easy to suppose that when you do a Varroa wash with 300 bees in a jar and you add ethanol, mm-hmm. that's the alcohol, or soapy water, you would probably get very similar results. I can't promise you, since I'm not aware if the research has been done, maybe it's being done now, but my hypothesis is that you would get very similar results. So you do this wash, you'll likely get the same number of mites within a few mites if you had done it with soap water versus alcohol. I think one of the reasons people have shied away from soap water is that when you start shaking up a jar of bees with alcohol, you just get bees, alcohol, and Varroa. But when you shake up a jar of bees with soap water, you get bees, Varroa, and a whole lot of suds and bubbles.
Yeah,
and
that's
very difficult to see Varroa.
I was going to say that too. The suds will probably like prevent you from seeing Varroa, especially mm-hmm. sometimes it's hard enough. You know, my eyesight's starting to get bad. So I'm not sure if I'd be able to see it through the suds.
But you know, for that matter, Amy, why soap water at all? Why not just water? And I think it would be neat to see a research project done on water versus alcohol versus soap water. Again, maybe that's already been done and I just don't know the literature as well as I should. And if it has, reader, listeners, please let me know. We'll try to correct this. But I can envision a scenario where some sort of killing agent, soap or ethanol, would cause a Varroa release from the bee more so than something like water. So I could buy the argument that maybe water is not quite as good to use as soap water or ethanol. But honestly, I just have to see the data. Someone needs to do the study, generate the data, and then I'll be able to answer the question with more authority. Until then, I would argue that soap, water, alcohol, assuming all else is the same number of bees, same volume of liquid, same amount of shaking for the same amount of time, I would guess you would get similar numbers of Varroa out of those jars if you were doing it one way or the other.
All right. Well, there's a call for beekeepers to go ahead and send us an email if you have that study or if you found that study anywhere. Thank you so much for the questions. Be sure to email us at honeybee@ifas.ufl.edu or send us your questions on our social media pages at UF Honeybee Lab.
Thank you for listening to Two Bees in a Podcast. For more information and resources on today's episode, check out the Honeybee Research Lab website at ufhoneybee.com. If you have questions you want answered on air, email them to us at honeybee@ifas.ufl.edu or message us on social media at UF Honeybee Lab on Instagram, Facebook, and Twitter. This episode was hosted by Jamie Ellis and Amy Vu. This podcast is produced and edited by Amy Vu and Sarah Sowers. Thanks for listening and see you next week.